It was also a drain on time, and a year or two into that, I went through a divorce and married again, and I know it was quite a strain on my new family relationships to have this on top of everything else. Very sharp deadline makes a difference, week after week after week.
So it was weekly then?
Oh, yeah, without remit. So that was part of it. But mostly it's what I just said. I still got 40 or 50 linear feet of files that pertain to the subjects I was researching in that vein. So that was my education in public affairs, basically, was the research that I started and then continued to do around this newspaper column.
What kind of topics did you select?
Well, they were not organized a priori with a particular reflection. About half of them had to do with what we would now call environmental issues of one sort or another, or related matters concerning to health and the world we live in. There wasn't much environmental news in the press in those days, which is hard to remember as well. So today there'd be much less need for it, or else it would be counter-commentary rather than commentary. Another, if that's half, maybe a quarter was devoted to national security, military, arms control, related kinds of issues, SALT, nuclear weapons bans, things of that kind. The stuff that would appear in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is one of the sources of impetus to be involved in this way. Leo Szilard was someone who kept urging me to do more. And the other were just miscellaneous scientific topics that might be of some interest about human nature, usually. It was called Science and Man. Today would have to be Science and Humankind. Or
not be an acceptable title today. Well, the ACS used to have a radio program called Men and Molecules,
yes,
too.
So.
You mentioned Leo Szilard a number of times,
mm-hmm.
And I was curious as to how his interest in, I mean, I picture Leo Szilard in a totally different thing, and how he was involved in this kind of work.
Well, Richard Rhodes has a beautiful account of his role in the making of the bomb. But after the war, he wanted to have nothing more directly to do with it. He decided to go into biophysics. He got an appointment at Chicago, and he recruited a then young fellow called Aaron Novick to be his lieutenant, somebody who had, he'd also worked at Los Alamos, but be his laboratory implementer. And they were a very interesting team. Aaron was interested in doing experiments and reaching things to an interesting conclusion, and Leo was wandering all over the place and theorizing about the nature of life in all kinds of dimensions and buttonholing people and using that very special physics mentality that he had for pursuing biological questions. He also very shrewdly organized what he called a phage seminar. Phage was a buzzword for the general area. And there was a lot going on in the Midwest in those days. And we'd meet once a month, usually in Chicago, but sometimes in Madison or in Urbana or Bloomington. Those are the main centers that we get together in, just talk about what was happening in this new area. So this was ostensibly for his education, but it got us together and also had the benefit of his kind of probing. So he was actively involved in related areas, and was in his lab, did the first repeats on crossing. That was not published. Their research got on to the uses of the chemostat, and this was a method of regulating the growth of bacteria by a continuous flow of a nutrient. You'd set up a bacterial culture, inoculate it, and then you'd have a drip that one drop every minute, that'd be fresh culture medium, and one drop every minute, the culture as a whole would be withdrawn. So it was a constant volume system and would come to a steady state. It could be set up in ways that was nutrient limited. So you had bacteria in a physiological steady state, but of various degrees of nutrient limitation. So how fast would a bug grow if it had concentration of 6 micromolar tryptophan compared to 10 micromolar, and so on. So they were able to do a lot of very quantitative studies on bacterial growth using that apparatus, and it suited them just fine as physicists to operate in that mode. And they did some very interesting things with it. So that was their actual, the main content of their biophysical investigations was growth of bacteria under various kinds of nutrient limitations in the chemostat, looking at genetic phenomena, accumulation of mutants, changes in mutation rates. They discovered anti-mutagens, things that would lower the spontaneous mutation rate using that system, so on. So they had some interesting things come out of it. But at the same time, Leo was very active in arms control matters, and certainly inspired me to try to pick up those same themes.
Well, that was in the height of the Cold War days, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you also were consulting, if I read your notes correctly, with somebody at Fort Detrick, and wondering whether there was biological warfare aspects of any of that.
Well, I didn't know how much of an offensive program they had going on, and I had no relationship to it. Werner Braun was my main contact, and he had a research program on the genetics of Brucella, and for what I knew of it, it was for the development of vaccines. I was vaguely aware that we were developing offensive weapons, and I was very much interested in arms control arrangements that would abolish it. I understood the need to do that bilaterally, that we couldn't, or at least at that time, I felt that we couldn't just unilaterally drop our interest in the matter and have the Russians continue with unhindered and unlimited programs, and that something ought to be bargained about. But I didn't get involved in the politics of that particular issue in any significant way until much later. I informed myself about it, and I saw BW as a horrible threat. It had to be stopped, but the focus of that would have been arms control arrangements, and it was hard to see how that was ever going to be negotiated and how it would be verified. We didn't have, until we had overhead inspection, we had nothing that would have been any benefit. And as we know from our experience with Iraq, even with it, it's and with a treaty, it's of limited utility. So that was my connection with that. But my main consulting then was commercial. And that's with the Bristol Laboratories, starting, I think, in 1950. They were in Syracuse, New York. So a little bit of a nuisance getting there from Madison to two towns that don't have direct air service. a fellow called Joe Lean was the person in charge of microbiological antibiotic development, and he wanted some inputs on how to use genetic technologies. They listened with great interest. They paid me what seemed like a great stipend. I don't know, it might have been $100 a month or something of that sort. Maybe it was 50. But never did anything with it. So. But it gave me some early introduction to how R&D works in that industry. And left me with less than a utmost opinion of the how far-sighted it was, and they were themselves the world leaders. They did. They were betting on a different horse. They had Sheehan doing the chemistry and worked out all kinds of semi-synthetic penicillins and so on. I mean, it was that very success made them less desperate to try to look to what we would today call biotechnology as a route to improvement. He would attend some of our consultants meetings, so.
Sheehan.
Mm-hmm. He's written a wonderful book about that experience.
Yes.
So that's how I got my first familiarity with how that kind of thing went on in the world. That was a long time ago.
You said flying was difficult. It was difficult at any, under any circumstances in 1950, let alone.
Well, if you had direct connection, it was great. Those DC-3s were wonderful airplanes. Took a little while, but.
A lot longer, yes.
It was more the schedules than the aircraft themselves. You know, if you were going across the country, it took a little longer.
During that 3-year period before you went to Berkeley.
Berkeley was just a summer, you know.
Right, but
okay.
There are a number of things that I want to.
Well, it's an interesting turning point,
yes.
Okay.
Were you feeling more and more comfortable with a university position and the way. You started out at Wisconsin, I'm going to do lots of research. Now you've got 3 years and you've got graduate students and you're getting the work done, but are you feeling more comfortable then with being in a university setting?
I was never uncomfortable with it. Never have been, never was, never will be, but
well,
I was becoming, you know, ingrained within it, and I think feeling that I was well integrated into Wisconsin, and I think whatever might have been in the background before I got there on anti-Semitism, it was never an issue, and I don't think it was even an issue underground after the first introductions. First of all, the world was changing, you know, and then, you know, as you get to know people, it becomes less important. And it was also notable that a number of other new appointments were Jewish people. There'd always been some in the H&S, but I may have been the very first one, or not very close to that, in the School of Agriculture. But then agriculture was becoming, the school as an academic unit was upgrading, taking itself much more seriously, setting higher and higher admission standards to when they were finally erased, and they were just as rigorous a program. It used to be a little bit demeaning. That was kind of the easy degree for dumb farm kids. And that's crazy on all sides. They're not dumb. They don't need an easy degree, and I think it was doing them a disservice to set less than the highest standards for them. And they've done just fine on a more integrated basis.
So at this point, then, you were pretty well convinced that you would stay in the academic track and weren't going to.
Oh, I never doubted it. I mean, I didn't need. I'd been in the academic track since I entered Columbia.
But the MD thoughts disappeared.
Oh, MD versus the rest. And, no, I.
Because in your writings, you seem to hang on to that little bit of.
Well,
what if I had stayed in medicine and
well, I saw the medical school as part of the university, and I would not have been interested in a medical school that wasn't. And that was roughly the case for the one at Madison until about 1955. I met John Bowers probably in 53, might have been in 50, might have been both, at Kurt Stern's house in Berkeley. Stern is was a professor of genetics, a real wonderful elder statesman in the field. His life work had been in Drosophila genetics, but he wrote a textbook in human genetics, and he taught that at Berkeley. It's a wonderful text. Anyhow, he'd gotten to know Bowers, who was the director of one of the major programs in the AEC on biological effects of radiation, which included a fair bit of genetics, genetic damage, and that kind of stuff. So he was an experimentalist, what I would call contract big science these days, but I didn't make those distinctions at that time. Well, I didn't know when I met him that he was being considered to be the new dean at Madison, and I'd gone on at some time about what I thought was right and wrong with medical education, didn't have an adequate scientific base, and so on. He turned up as dean, asked me to come and see him. Was I serious about my interest in the matter? And I said I sure was. What would I want to do about it? And I said, well, how about starting a department of genetics in the medical school? And he said, sure. So that happened.
Just that easy.
Well, when you had he wanted to make a splash and wanted to do something distinctive, it was something he could have some feel for himself, and it was a very rational thing for him to do given all those premises. There were some issues about how to pay for it, which and when push came to shove, it wasn't always as easy to get the appointments through that I thought he had promised that direction. But his heart was in the right place.
Where was biochemistry?
In the ag school.
In the ag school?
Mm-hmm. Now, he set up something called the Enzyme Institute, which had some autonomy, but was at least grew out of the ag school. And it may have been biochemistry's answer to this question about having an acknowledgement of its roots in basic science. But it was the same cast of characters. A couple of new people were recruited. David Green came in. And I'd had high expectations of it, but I couldn't get any of them interested either in DNA chemistry or in protein synthesis. Hmm. They thought it was too hard. And it really wasn't until I left they recruited Corona to the Enzyme Institute. I might not have gone if he'd been there.
Well, now what happened to genetics in the ag school? That it still
stayed there. Well, what's eventually happened, that's sensible. The two departments have again merged, and they have a rather unique situation. It's a department which is both in the ag school and the medical school, so it has a unified administration, gets some of its budget slots on each side. I think the medical side of it is the predominant one today in terms of where the action is.
Well, the Berkeley summer, your notes are filled with all kinds of things about Berkeley.
Well, it was an exciting experience. I had met Mike Dudaroff and Roger Stanier at Cold Spring Harbor a couple of times. I think Esther had known one or the other of them too. She'd spent a summer in Van Neel's course at Pacific Grove, the Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford. And Stanier was very much Van Neel's protege and collaborator. It was a close net. And I think that was the immediate instigation, but yeah, and they were not segregated departments. It was a big department of life sciences. And they just invited me to be a visiting professor for the summer and to bring bacterial genetics to that campus in that way. It was exciting. It was my first trip to California. Rather richer environment, the Berkeley campus, but especially the depth that was going on there in the virus laboratory, the microbiologist that I just mentioned. It seemed like it was a somewhat more stimulating place. And you could work there in the summertime, which you couldn't do in Madison. So I really first developed a yen that I might want to move west sometime. I visited again more briefly in 1953. This was to receive the Lilly Award lectureship. Not reinforced it. At that time, Stanford was still pretty sleepy. Ed Tatum had gone back there, but not much else was going on. And the medical school was still at San Francisco, so I didn't give much thought to Stanford as a place. And I think we began talking about possibly someday I might come to Berkeley. So that started in the summer of 50.
No, the Korean War started then, too.
Yeah. While we're on the route, we drove across the country, and I remember getting the news on the way.
That was also the McCarthy era.
That's right.
And you commented about some of those. Were you caught up in that at all? Did you have discussions with the people there about that?
A lot of discussions, more in California than Wisconsin. McCarthy was, until he became indiscreet and it was his downfall, he was very careful not to bring this stuff home, where his own constituents could look more closely at it and know what kind of bullshit he was peddling. So, very limited degree of that kind of red baiting in Wisconsin. A little bit of it, but nothing compared to what you saw in Washington and elsewhere. And they did make big fuss about the loyalty oath. My view was, I didn't see any problem with the substance of it, but I thought it was egregious that the regents felt it necessary to impose it. That was humiliating and insulting, and that they should have done exactly the opposite. And say, presumption of innocence to proven guilty, and there's no reason in the world to think there's any problem. And I don't think there was. I don't think any security risk has ever come out of Berkeley in that regard. I have, to this day, still mixed feelings about that whole episode. I think there was a core of pro-Stalinism in this country. Anybody who could have survived the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact in 1939 and not see Russia as the autarky that it was was being pretty much of a dupe. I took quite seriously the issues of the defections and the spies who were tried and convicted.
Rosenberg,
yeah. I thought and still do think that there was a pretty good case, that they were traitors, and that there was some level of serious revolutionary activity that was a conspiracy to overthrow the government that was supported from Moscow, but that McCarthy had just amplified it way out of any kind of reasonable proportions. And I don't think that any of the people he himself fingered, didn't think then and still though now, were guilty of what he was claiming. So he was, you know, drawing on a current of fear and concern that had some tiny core of merit than involving anybody. But I also felt that we were being victimized by the communists as well as by the right, that they kind of needed one another. And this notion of covering up on whether you'd ever been a member of the party and all the rest of it was something that the hardcore communists were eager to inculcate, not primarily to protect themselves, as the most evident of them were quite visible, but in order to divide and weaken the country. And I guess I would have favored a view of the matter that would have said, yes, I was a communist. I didn't do anything wrong. I was complying with the law. And I'm going to stand by that. And if more people had done that, and I think 80% of the ones who took the Fifth Amendment would have been in that category, I think it would have disarmed McCarthy in the first place. So McCarthy was a tool of the hardcore communists as much as vice versa. I really felt we were being done in by extremists on both sides. But I could, you know, I had a lot of sympathy for what was then authentically the liberal element and view of the matter, and I thought there were civil liberties questions involved in those kinds of inquiries. So I supported the opposition to the oath, but I thought it was a bad strategy to oppose it. It would have been a better one to say, yes, I was a communist, and I had good reasons for it at the time, and if I'm not today, I have repudiated, and maybe some others don't share that, and maybe they have undertaken some activities that ought to have further inquiry, but there's no reason for me to be involved in that. That's a very unpopular view, and I don't espouse it too loudly anywhere. People might misunderstand it, and it would be it would come under attack from both the right and the left today, so...
It was a very plausible one. I mean, certainly people who joined the party in the 30s, in the midst of the Depression, it was a
thousands of people did, and they had no reason to hide it. This is what the... Now, they began to, because if it became something that you were ashamed of, then people would think that with this smoke, there's fire, and et cetera, et cetera. I really think could have been disarmed. That would have taken some courage. I don't know if I would have had the courage myself to do it, but it was not a very good defense. People got fired anyhow. And the notion that you could somehow escape because you wouldn't be found out because somebody didn't tell on you, I thought was pretty foolish. It fed into McCarthy. He was one of the vilest people we've ever had, and I never had any hesitation saying that.
Towards the end of the McCarthy era, was the university affected at all?
Hardly at all. There were one or two minor skirmishes, but when he started going after a couple of Wisconsinites, all the local press that had been sort of divided about him. Started denouncing him too. And of course, it was crazy when he started going out after Eisenhower. He was finished. I mean, that was absolutely. No, I wouldn't say that. I can't swear that there was no single person at the university who was somehow singled out or injured, but it was nothing like big an issue there as it was in California. I don't think the Regents took that much attention of in terms of these symbolic acts of genuflection.